This is Shoshana Bryan. I'm the Senior Director of the Jewish Policy Center. I'd like to welcome you all to our conference call with Michael Ledeen. I understand we have an excellent representation of people on the line, and I know we have an excellent speaker. Michael Ledeen is a member of the Jewish Policy Center's Board of Fellows. He's the Freedom Scholar at the Foundation for Defense of Democracies and author of the Faster Please column for PJ Media. So rather than me telling you about Michael, I'm going to let Michael talk. Michael, would you join us?
Yes, I'm here. Thank you, and thank you for inviting me. It's flattering and fun to be here, and I hope we have a good time. I am a Freedom Scholar at the Foundation for the Defense of Democracies. I'm an historian. I have a PhD in modern European history from the University of Wisconsin, and I've written so far 37 books, and I'm working on the 38th, which is about the Italian Jews today. But our subject today is Iran, and I should tell you, I don't speak Farsi. I've never been to Iran. God willing, I'll never go to Iran. I'm not one of those who's fascinated and mesmerized by its culture, by its beauty, and all of that. Iran is something that happened to me. And it happened in 1979, back when I was editing the Washington Quarterly. And the Shah was overthrown. And it was obvious that I had to commission an article for the Quarterly on Carter and the fall of the Shah, and I found a really good guy, Bill Lewis, who had just retired from the State Department, who knew a lot about Iran, and I said, please write a piece called Carter and the Fall of the Shah. And he worked on it for a while and came back to me and said, okay, here's what I've got, here's what I don't have, and here's what I know we have to get if it's going to be a well-done article. So anyway, I ended up working on that article with him. The article was a big hit, and then Knopf asked us to do a book on it. We did a book called Debacle, Carter and the Fall of the Shah. And so I was off on my Iranian adventure, and over the years, since 1979, Iran has just come back and grabbed me repeatedly. And the best place to start about the United States and Iran is to say that Iran declared war on us in 1979 and has been waging war against us ever since. And in all the presidents that we've had from Carter to Trump, we have yet to have a president, left, right, Democrat, Republican, doesn't matter. We have yet to have a president who has designed a way to effectively fight back against the Iranians. And in recent years, when American troops were in Iraq and Afghanistan, our military commanders have found that our soldiers are being kidnapped, shot, killed, and so forth by Iranian forces. And I want to stress Iranian forces. Because a lot of the time in the press, we hear about Iranian proxies, but we don't hear that much about Iranian forces. And yet, Iranians, first person, and I include Hezbollah in that, because Hezbollah is really part of this regime. It was created by Iran, it's trained by Iran, funded by Iran, trained by Iran, and so forth. So it is Iran for all practical purposes. They come after us, and the regime pays rewards for people who kill Americans, kidnap Americans, wound Americans, attack Americans, and so it goes. And keep in mind that Al-Qaeda, after we drove them out of Afghanistan in 2001 and 2002, relocated their headquarters to Tehran. And they have been operating out of Tehran thanks to either, depending on how you interpret it, the toleration or the active support of the Iranian regime. They've been operating against us out of Iran ever since. So arguably, Iran is the most important policy issue for the United States. It's our major enemy. It's a declared enemy. We're not going to talk them out of it. There's no way to negotiate some kind of deal with Iran whereby they will stop attacking us. Even this big Iran nuclear deal does not do that. It doesn't even address it. It only talks about nuclear projects and ballistic missiles and things of that nature. But it does not at all even begin to talk about the serious war that's been going on between Iran and the United States since 1979, which is a long time, going on 40 years. The Iranians are staging what they call elections, which will take place at the end of this week. It doesn't really matter who wins it and who becomes the next president of the country, whether Rouhani is reelected or whether somebody else, probably this person, Raisi, succeeds him, because there is a person in Tehran with the title Supreme Leader. And I've always said that if you want to have a sign on your desk, that's the one you want, Supreme Leader, because all key decisions are made by him. All decisions of any consequence are made by him. If you want to look at Syria, for example, and understand the relationship between Iran and Syria, just look at what Khamenei, the supreme leader, says. And he has said to his people now for many years that the survival of Assad is more important than his own survival. And therefore, Iranian forces have free rein. They can spend all the money they want. They can do whatever they want. They can attack whoever they want. And he will support them. The important thing is that Assad wins. And just a few years ago, when it looked like Assad was going to fall and all kinds of pundits were saying Assad's going to fall, I always said to them, listen, Iran is prepared to do anything to keep Assad in power. It's terribly important for them. Hezbollah operates out of Syria. It's based in Syria. And if Assad falls, where are they going to go? What are the Iranians going to do with them? That's their foreign legion. It's got to be operational. And so the Syrian question for them is literally a question of life and death. And you can see that because typically the Iranians prefer to use Arab proxies in their fighting against their enemies. But in Syria, they have sent thousands of Iranians themselves to fight against the people we support, against the enemies of Assad. And so there is the first time since the revolution that we have seen first-person Iranian forces on the battlefield, and lots of them have been killed, including senior military officers. So that is why in the world today, arguably the most important Iranian is not Khamenei, but Soleimani, General Soleimani, who commands Iranian forces outside the country. And the Russian alliance in Syria is the result of trips that Soleimani took to Moscow a few years ago when he met with Putin and said, hey, we're losing, and we're losing a lot of people. Do something. And Putin said, what a fine idea. I think we will. And so now there's Russian troops, Russian bases, and so on, in cahoots with the Iranians, fighting this war in Syria. And it's a really big problem. So The way to think about Iran right now, there are two basic points. Number one, Iran's at war with us. Iran is devoted to the destruction of the United States. This is not, as is often said, just a regional question. It's a global issue. Ahmadinejad, when he was president, gave a famous speech in which he said the Iranian people have to prepare themselves to rule the world. And that is the way they think about it. And that is what they're getting ready to do. And there is no way for us to talk our way out of this, and we cannot opt our way out of this, because this war is going to end only when there's a winner and a loser, and we're either going to win it or lose it. And we can win it. And actually, the hell of it is that we can win this fairly easily. If you think back to the end of the Cold War, when the Soviet Empire imploded and went away, that was in large part a result of American policy. We supported the internal enemies of Gorbachev and the Soviet regime. And I put it to you that if we were able to bring down the Soviet Empire, which was a very big deal with a great army and first-class forces and plenty of resources and lots of money, we can certainly do the same thing with Iran, because Iran is a country which screws up almost everything it undertakes. It's got an unprecedented level of messing up its own system. If you look at Iran on paper, if you were a Pentagon person or a State Department person and your president said, "Tell me about Iran," you would say, well, on paper, Iran should be one of the most successful countries in the world. It's got lots of oil. It has other natural resources. It has very good agricultural terrain. It produces and can produce all kinds of foodstuffs, and including pistachio nuts, the best in the world. It's got an educated working force. It has one of the best educational systems in the Middle East. It has women who work and very talented ones. It's a great cultural force. Some of the best movies in the world come out of Iran. So it should be, and it's a big country, 75 million people. So you would expect it to be a great success story. Instead, it's a basket case. Every major indicator of political and economic misery is there in full force. Very high suicide rate, drug addiction rate, depression, and so forth. And the people are often starving. And the workers are not paid. If you followed Iranian news day by day, you would be astonished at how many strikes there are going on and how many protests are taking place all over the country every single day. And the Iranian people detest this regime by and large. Upwards of when the Iranians themselves take polls, they invariably come up with numbers of well over 70% of the population would like to see regime change in the country. They do not think of themselves primarily as part of the Middle East. They think of themselves as Westerners. Remember that Iran is not an Arab country. Half the population are Persians, not Arabs. The most important Arabs, paradoxically, are down in the south in the oil-producing regions, and they're on strike very often against the regime. So it's misery, it's constant protest, and it's acknowledged failure by the regime. The regime itself admits its own failures. The biggest one right now is a drastic water shortage. They built dams all over the country, and the artificial bodies of water that these dams created are now drying up. And so agricultural is suffering. Drinking water is in short supply all over the country. It's a misery. If we were to support the Iranian people against the regime in Tehran, I have every reason to think it would succeed. But we don't do that. No American president does that. Instead, a series of American presidents have convinced themselves that we can make a deal with Iran. Most people do not know, for example, that George W. Bush thought he had made a deal with Iran. Condoleezza Rice negotiated a deal very similar to the one that Obama finally made. And she and her deputy went to New York to wait at the United Nations for the Iranians to come and sign it. And everything was laid on. We issued more than 300 visas to Iranians to accompany Larijani to come to New York to sign this thing. No one really knows what happened to those visas. But in any case, she flew to New York, and the Iranians never showed up. And so before Obama, there was no deal. Obama was the first American president who came into office knowing that he wanted a deal. All the others came in vowing to take a hard line with Iran, to fight back, to teach them lessons and all of that. Nobody really did anything serious to Iran until first Bush tried to negotiate this thing that fell through. And then Obama came in and did the nuclear deal. And it's important to notice that nobody ever signed that agreement with Iran. It's a verbal agreement. The Iranians haven't signed it. We haven't signed it. The Europeans haven't signed it, nor the Russians, nor the Chinese. It's just something. And our texts differ in many regards. The Iranians interpret it very differently from the way we do. So we don't even, so when Trump now says, or his people now say, well, we would talk to the Iranians, and we would try to get a better deal and so forth, keep in mind that the Iranians have no intention of making a formal deal with the United States. They want us dead. They don't want an arrangement. They don't want peace with us. They are vowed to our destruction. And we have the crucial political weapon, support for the Iranian people, most of whom want this regime changed. And if we started to do that, I think things inside Iran might change very quickly. When the Iranians celebrate their New Year's, no ruse, our public statement should not be the sort that are made and of the sort that Trump just made recently, which is to say we love Iranians. Iranians are terrific. They're among our most successful immigrants, especially the ones in California. Really, that's what we said. We should say we want freedom for the Iranian people, and we will support Iranian people who work for their own freedom. And we will fight against a regime that kills Americans and kidnaps Americans and holds American hostages. That's the kind of policy we want. We don't have to bomb them. We certainly don't have to invade them. All these born-again bombers, as Scoop Jackson used to call them, who come out and say, you know, we should attack Iran, we should attack the nuclear sites and so forth, I don't believe that's necessary. I think political change will do the job. I think we're in a good position to do it. I think the unpredictable nature of this president actually worries the Iranian regime more than predictable presidents like Bush or Obama. And I think if we came out and waged a political campaign against the Iranians, we could change the world. So those are the main points. That's my main sermon on Iran. I'll be glad to take your questions.
Michael, thank you. Participants, as you know, questions should be directed to info@jewishpolicycenter.org. We've got it set up here so that we can read them right off the screen. And Michael, we do have several questions that have already come in. People, if you'd like to add more questions, please do info@jewishpolicycenter.org. First question is there a viable alternative to the regime, and how would we get there?
Well, I think so. Nobody knows for sure. But in 2009, millions of people took to the streets at election time because they felt the election had been stolen from them. They thought that most people had voted for Mousavi, but instead the regime declared that Ahmadinejad had been reelected. There were more people in the streets of Tehran in 2009 than there had been at the time of the overthrow of the Shah in 1979. And the regime certainly thinks that that these forces still exist and that they are powerful. And you can see that by the fact that Mousavi has been under house arrest since 2011. But the regime has not dared to put him on trial, let alone execute him. And remember, this is a regime, the Rouhani regime, oftenly misidentified as a reformist regime that has executed 50% more Iranians than Ahmadinejad did. So the regime's afraid of it, and the regime's afraid of them. And I take their behavior to be confirmation of that. And those people want an end to the Islamic Republic. They want a secular government, a modeled on Western society. So what we should be pushing for is a referendum on the form of government Iran should have, and then free elections to elect the people to run it.
Thank you. There are certain things that people have suggested the United States might do, if for no other reason than to irritate the Iranians. Have you heard anything on the possibility that the Boeing commercial aircraft deal to Iran might be delayed or halted?
Well, it certainly should be, because there's no real distinction. It's kind of like the Soviet Union. There's no real distinction between civilian and military there. They use so-called civilian planes for military missions. If you go on Twitter, you'll find that my colleague, Emanuele Ottolenghi, daily tracks flights from Iran to Syria. They are certainly carrying weapons and money and trainers and advisors for the regime forces. And those planes are, for the most part, so-called civilian planes. So if the Boeing deal goes through, we'll just be selling the Iranians better airplanes to wage their war currently in Syria and Iraq. So I think we should kill that deal, and I think Congress should do it. I think Trump should do it.
Thank you. Does Iran still actively arm the Houthi rebels in Yemen? And if so, is there a way for us to intercept or stop that?
Well, they certainly are. Arming them more than ever and bragging about it. In fact, they say it so publicly. It's not a secret. What can we do about it? Well, I suppose we could work with the Saudis and fight against them. And we are helping the Saudis to some extent. I also think we should be much more aggressive in the waters around Yemen. There are Iranian ships that still launch missiles in the general area of American warships in the Gulf, and I believe that we should sink any Iranian ship that does that.
Thank you. What is the relationship between Turkey and Iran these days?
Good question. It changes almost every week. There is an established economic cooperation agreement between Turkey and Iran. And there are no customs checks on the border. The trucks just go back and forth, and a lot of Russian equipment comes that way, comes down through Turkey and into Iran. On the other hand, there have been several scandals which have worsened relations between the regime and they disagree on Syria. The Turks are opposed to Assad, and the Iranians are violently pro-Assad. So it's a complicated relationship, and it changes very often.
And where do the Russians fit in? You mentioned that Turkey and Iran have different views of Assad, but yet Turkey, Russia, and Iran are the three signatories to the deconfliction zone agreement. Is there a way to use the Russians against the Iranians? Is there a way to move the Russians in Syria?
Is Putin willing to betray the Iranians? Well, the Iranians think so. They worry about it all the time. At the moment, I think their interests are still common. And I think, and I wrote about this, the problem is we have really nothing to offer the Russians in return. I mean, the Russians now have seaport and air bases inside Syria, and they're doing it because of the joint campaign they're waging along with the Iranians. So they have no obvious reason to betray Khamenei right now. They might do it if we had something serious to offer them. But we don't, and that's largely thanks to the 8 years of Obama when we pulled prematurely out of Iraq and never got a firm grip on Afghanistan. And so what can we say to them? If we were in a strong position in Iraq and a strong position in Afghanistan, we might say to them, hey, you know, we'll let you keep your bases. We won't meddle with that, but you cooperate with us, and we will make your life easier in Syria and Iraq and Afghanistan.
Could Crimea and Ukraine be something we could offer the Russians? I know that creates different kinds of problems with the Europeans, but there was some talk in Washington that what the Russians were looking for was a way out of the European and U.S. sanctions over Ukraine and Crimea.
We could offer to lift sanctions, and it may well be that that if the Russian economy gets worse and worse, you know, oil prices still seem to me to be headed down, and if oil prices still keep going down, the Russians will suffer, and then the option of lifting sanctions might be more interesting.
Okay, another question from a listener. With their large population and inefficient economy, how do the Iranians have the economic capacity to fund their proxy wars and maintain Hezbollah at the level at which it does?
Well, we give them money. Look at that deal. The nuclear deal was a deal to give billions of dollars to Iran in exchange for promising to be good. So a great deal of that money is coming from us, American taxpayers.
That's a scary thought. Would you address the nascent alliance? The question says alliance, I would say relationship, between the Sunni Arab countries and Israel. Is that likely to be effective against Iran?
Well, I haven't seen. One of the things that that baffles me about the world is that neither the Sunni Arabs, primarily the Saudis, but also the Gulf states, nor Israel, seems to have figured out how hollow the Iranian regime is and how effective a political strategy against Iran would be. And so, you know, somebody ought to try to educate these people. I really don't get why the Saudis are not supporting the Iranian internal opposition. It seems so obvious to me, but they don't. And it's a lot cheaper than funding a war in Yemen, I'll tell you that.
I think that must be true. There was a news report that in Syria, based on the deconfliction zones and where they're going to be, the Iranians are moving their one of their main supply lines about 140 miles to the south. The farther south they go, the closer they get to Israel, the more the Israelis begin to worry. Is the Russian presence controlling where Iran will go, or is Iran going to control where it goes? And how much of a threat does that pose to Israel?
Well, you know, Iran has vowed to destroy Israel. Although, for the most part, they vowed to destroy Israel after they have destroyed us. We are their primary target. Iran has to have a supply line that runs from Iran across Iraq and into Syria. Can the Russians stop that? Yeah, they probably could. Do they want to stop it? No, because they'd rather Iranians get killed in Syria than Russians get killed in Syria. And, of course, don't forget Lebanon. It's a Hezbollah regime, and that means it's an Iranian regime. So the Iranians are in a fairly strong position. What are the Russians going to do? Withdraw? That just cuts their own nose to spite their face. They have no reason to do that.
Okay, and I think this may be our last question, unless people want to continue to send them to info@jewishpolicycenter.org. Is there a significant presence of Iranian Kurds that you believe would fight against the Iranian regime? And how might they benefit from our support of Iraqi Kurds or Syrian Kurds?
Well, there's good Kurds and bad Kurds. And there are lots of Iranian Kurds, and they increasingly cooperate or collude, to use the current word. They cooperate with each other. So the Turkish Kurds, Iranian Kurds, Iraqi Kurds, and Syrian Kurds talk to each other, cooperate with one another, and from time to time talk about how wonderful it would be if there were a gigantic Kurdistan. I think that the idea of Kurdistan is attractive. They're certainly very good fighters. We get along well with them. We don't have the religious conflicts with them that we have with radical Islamists, whether Sunni or Shia. The Israelis like Kurds too, so that's part of a working alliance. On the other hand, there are Kurds that we consider terrorists and call them terrorists, and it would be very difficult for us to cooperate with PKK. Not just because it creates problems with Turks, but because it creates problems with our own doctrine, with our own notion of how we want to wage war against terror. I think that that our cooperation with some Kurds, very important, very desirable, and by and large it's going well. The notion of a big Kurdistan involving all the Kurdish groups is something that's going to be very hard to work out, and not just because the Turks don't want it and the Iranians don't want it and the Iraqis have their doubts about it, but because their internal divisions are very strong as well. You know, a lot of them, if you read their literature, really something. It's like a throwback to the old Soviet days. I mean, they use this Marxist language, which is really quite something.
So we did get a late entry in the questions, and it's a small question, so I think we can close with this. Would you talk about the strategic relationship between Iran and China? How's that for a small question?
Most Iranian leaders I'm given to understand right now have their ill-gotten gains in Chinese banks. So there's a big financial relationship. The Chinese want Iranian oil. There are actually parts of Iran which might as well be Chinese. They are governed by China. Only Chinese work there. They are in oil-producing regions, and they are fenced off, wired off, walled off from the rest of Iran. It's a very close relationship. Very close indeed.
On that note, I'm going to thank you for your time and thank you for a really excellent presentation on behalf of the members of the Jewish Policy Center. Thank you. I hope we'll see you again.
Well, thank you. Anytime. It's a pleasure and a treat.
And that ends our conversation for today. Thank you all.
This concludes today's conference call. Thank you for participating. You may all disconnect.